Hello, and welcome to Out in the Bay, our weekly show about gay life from San Francisco. I'm Marilyn Pittman. As we fight for marriage equality here in California, we often don't talk about the intricacies of marriage, what it takes to succeed and be happy. In the world of lesbian relationships, phrases such as intimacy issues and lesbian bed death have abounded. Why? Are lesbians different than gay men and heterosexual couples? What are the perils of being in a same-sex couple over the long term? My guest is a clinical psychologist and the author of Sexual Intimacy for Women, A Guide for Same-Sex Couples. Dr. Glenda Corwin, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, what have you learned in your research about lesbians and the problems they have with sexual intimacy?
One of the big questions that I'm asked a lot is lesbian bed death a reality, loss of sexuality in a long-term relationship? And is it any different for lesbian couples than for straight couples? We don't really have current scientific data to answer that question now, but there was a very solid study done in the mid-80s by Bloomstein and Schwartz at the University of Washington after 10 years of living together. About 67%, about two-thirds of heterosexual couples say that they are still having sex at least twice a month, and only 15% of lesbian couples.
Wow.
So that's a significant difference. Yes,
well,
vast is the word.
It is a vast separation, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In my practice, I've been in practice for about 20 years, and about half of the clients I work with are identify as lesbian. And I keep hearing this term over and over, lesbian bed death, with people asking, is this inevitable? Is this just as good as it gets?
Huh.
And because the other question that that brings up, and to me it's a very poignant question, it's a question a young woman came in and asked me a few years ago, and this was actually the first time I sat down and started writing about this, because she walked into my office and said, is lesbian bed death inevitable? And by the time I gathered my thoughts to ask, you know, what leads you to ask that question, she started telling me her story, and it was a very typical story. She and her partner had been together for 12 years. They hadn't had sex for 5 years. She wanted more intimacy. Her partner was saying to her, quote, this is pretty normal for lesbians. And so what this young woman was asking me was, is this normal? Is this, should I change my expectations or change my partner? And I don't think that lesbian bed death is inevitable at all. I have had the fortune of knowing a percentage of women who've been together a long time, 20 and 30 years, who still maintain an active sex life. And so I wanted to really focus on that group and find out how are they different from others. This is a specific thing that was interesting to me, and I did a survey online about 3 years ago about lesbian sexual patterns. And I wanted to look at what were the different responses from the women who were still sexually active. And by sexually active in the literature is defined as having sex more than twice a month. Some people say that's not much, but it's...
And some people say I'd be happy with that.
Exactly.
That sounds good to
me.
A woman told me
the other day, her partner said, well, we can do better than that. And she said, well, we haven't had sex in a year, so, you know.
So anything's...
This would be great. Yeah. But there was only one question on the survey that really differentiated the two groups. Well, first I'll tell you that on the question, do you think regular sexual contact is important in an ongoing relationship? 90% of the women who took this survey said yes. They thought this was very important. But then on the question, do you regularly set aside time for sex? Only 20% said they did. And that 20% was the 20% who were still sexually active. In some ways, that's a no-brainer, right? If you if you value something, then you make it a priority in your time. But what stood out to me from this survey was that we seem to value sexual intimacy a lot, but we don't prioritize it. Hmm. And then that group that is more active, that's what they did. And then I followed it up with some, about 30 of these women agreed to talk to me on the phone anonymously, which was great, so I could ask them more in-depth questions. And when I asked them the question of, do you plan for sex, the ones who were active laughed and said, yeah, of course we do. Otherwise, it would never happen.
And I think but heterosexual people listening, gay men listening, probably would say the same thing, that you do have to make time for it. And you have to say, we're going to set aside some time and make a plan for it. Don't you think that's a sort of common thing among other kinds of couples?
Theme.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very common. I think, and it gets into another huge issue, if I may just move into the myth of spontaneity. In my survey or in the interviews, when I asked the women who were not having sex, when I asked them that question about planning, they said, oh, no, that would feel too awkward and contrived. You know, it needs to be spontaneous. So, but see, what I think is interesting is that when we ask people to talk about when is the time that sex really felt spontaneous, when you had, you know, sexual desire felt spontaneous, people always talk about the early stages of dating. But then when you really think about what you did when you were first dating somebody, it's incredibly intentional.
It just seems like somebody needs to initiate or be a catalyst, and maybe when you have two women, there's not as much of that initiatory energy.
Well, I think that's true. Definitely initiation is one of the main things that women say slow them down or cause them to have problems. And I don't know if energy or also just behavioral repertoire. We are not trained to initiate sex.
No, women are
and
not.
I'm speaking generalities. But
well,
I think
we're trained
culture,
as young girls.
Yeah, we're trained
girls.
To respond.
Right.
And often we're trained to resist, which is important, you know, for safety reasons, of course, to resist unwanted sex. But we've learned a lot about saying no to sex, and we haven't learned that much about how to say yes or how to start it up. So I agree that's definitely an issue, I think, that's compounded with two women.
Do you think if the two women have more of an opposite energy, male-female-wise, in other words, one woman is more butch or more femme, I'm just curious.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I don't tend to think of it in terms of the butch or feminine, but that would be one way to frame it. I think of it, well, first of all, I have to say, in my experience with the couples that I have known who do sustain an active sex life for years and years, these women have been very intentional about it, and most of them have some kind of contract. They did at some point early in the relationship agree, you know, we're going to have sex at least twice a month, or we're not going to let more than 2 weeks go by without at least talking about it. So I see that. But on the butch femme question, you know, intuitively that makes sense. And I think women who identify as butch, you know, do see themselves as the ones who take initiative, and they've developed a skill set with that. That's great.
By the way, you're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is Dr. Glenda Corwin. Her book, Sexual Intimacy for Women, A Guide for Same-Sex Couples, is a detailed exploration of the obstacles and issues many lesbians, and for that matter, all couples may have in maintaining a healthy sexual intimacy in their relationships. You can find out more at drglendacorwin.com. Back to the word intentional. That's really a real key in your book, along with all the other things I want to get to. But describe what that means for those lesbians who are still having regular sex, as you defined it, what that means to have that intention, and why that's hard for some lesbian couples, many it seems, to develop.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's hard for all of us to develop, and for women in particular. So with lesbian couples, I think often you just have women's issues doubled up. intention means, you know, it means being very deliberate and mindful about sex. And that, again, is not what we're trained to do. We're sort of taught that we should be swept away by waves of passion or, you know, carried away. But the idea that you sit down and very consciously say, I want to have an active sex life with my partner. I want to be sure that we're making love fairly often. I want to even put a number on if it helps keep on track. Mm-hmm. It's being very conscious about it, very deliberate, and stating that that's your intention. And then it also includes, of course, paying attention to the things that kind of that nurture sexual energy. And that gets into, maybe we'll talk about the whole idea of foreplay or 24-hour foreplay.
Yeah, what is, you mentioned this, what is 24-hour? You have this thing in your book, 24-hour foreplay, and that just sounds like, wow, I don't have that much time, besides it would get boring and I have other things to do. But what do you mean by that?
Well, you may be thinking of an old-fashioned definition of foreplay, which would kill anybody, but that term actually came out of some sexual intimacy workshops. Foreplay technically is, one of the definitions is activities preceding the main event. And when it's used in sex therapy literature, it refers to the fact that we need some time to warm up. We need some time to get in the mood. And it's not just, you know, the physical stimulation 10 minutes before intercourse. That's how most people learn that term. It's talking about taking a day or two to really kind of do the planning that you did when you were dating. If you think about those dating activities, are really a type of foreplay. You're doing all these different activities getting ready for the main event. And so the 24-hour term just came up because somebody in the workshop laughed and said, gosh, this would take at least 24 hours. So we decided to call it 24-hour foreplay.
I like it. It's a sort of build. It sort of seems like you're talking about sort of building the desire and building, heading towards a goal and knowing you are and making it, by the time it happens, just you're completely ready and you're completely in the mood, both of you, because these other steps have been taken to bond you, to bring you together, to be tender or romantic or have fun.
Exactly. And it also, I think, helps a lot with the anxiety about initiating, because if you think about initiating foreplay, that's not quite as threatening as initiating sex, you know.
Yeah, that's
inviting,
true.
Saying, let's go to dinner and talk so we can get our emotional connection going, or let's go to the spa or the, you know, hot tub and get our
bodies,
little sensual awareness going. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the whole issue of erotic imagination, which is also important.
Which you also write about, of course. I want to talk about this one chapter, desire discrepancy. What can you share with us about that?
What people do is argue about who's really in control. The person with less desire often complains, you're pressuring me, you're trying to control me. I don't feel like being sexual when you're trying to get me to do something I don't want to do, therefore you're controlling. The person who has higher desire says, well, you're the one in charge of whether we have sex or not. I want it and you don't, and what's happening is what you want. So you have more power. The solution to that, of course, is to find ways to get on the same team.
How much do you think internalized homophobia has to do with lesbian bed death or difficulty with lesbians in their sexual desire or occurrence?
I'm glad you asked that question because it gives me a chance to say something that I really like to say, which is, I think the problem is externalized heterocentrism. We live in a heterosexual world, and most of our heterosexual friends have at least had the opportunity to hear some positive connotation about sexuality. It's, you know, for myself, I was raised in a conservative Protestant home. But even with pretty conservative religious values, sexual intimacy between a married couple was considered a good thing, a positive thing. And that is something that lesbian couples and gay men, we did not grow up hearing, this is great. When you grow up, I hope you meet the right woman and, you know, really fall in love and that you can enjoy sexual intimacy with her. It is not valued.
And it's not reflected. It's not mirrored.
It's not mirrored, exactly.
Maybe more.
So that's what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Maybe more now. I mean, maybe now it's more than certainly when we were growing up.
Certainly. Certainly it is more now. And I'm not sure. Sometimes that seems to be purely in an entertainment capacity. But it helps. All of it helps.
Well, that brings me to the L word, because I was going to ask you, is lesbian bed death more prevalent in women the boomer generation, the feminists who came out like I did in the early 70s, my age group, then, for example, in the age group of the L word, which is women in their 30s or maybe 40s, but generally 30s. Younger women, are they freer? Are they more expressive? Are they more able to communicate? Are they more into making the arrangements and deals about it? Do they suffer from fewer problems?
Well, you'd think so, wouldn't you? But I don't know.
You'd think so.
I can tell you in my clinical experience and on my survey too, the women who come in and talk to me about not having any sexual desire, just as many women in their 30s say that to me as women in their 50s.
Wow.
And and I on the survey also looking at age differences, it's really pretty evenly distributed. But, you know, this is not a real broad survey, and there could be, I hope that you're right, that it's easier now. I can just tell you in my experience in my office, I've had women who are 28 years old talk to me about not having any sexual energy and tell me that they wonder if it's their hormones, if they're premenopausal. And I think if you're wondering that at 28, there's not much hope here for your hormones to kick in. So,
well, and let's talk about aging and hormones. One of your chapters mm-hmm. is about aging and hormones. Now, I heard on TV, so it must be true, that orgasms give you up to 6 hours of endorphin relief. In other words, as I've said, as a comic at this point, it's an analgesic. I need some. I better take some. Honey, get in here.
Right.
You would think.
For medicinal purposes.
Well, you know, hello, I really believe this. Having mm-hmm. suffering from various aging discomforts that I do, it does help. You would think that sexual activity would increase in our later years to help with the pain. And certainly the experience, well, I won't go into that, but there's in fact more pleasure mm-hmm. in my experience than mm-hmm. ever before. And mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, just because you get old doesn't mean you don't need, your body doesn't need, in fact, doesn't benefit from sex. And yet there is this sort of idea in your book you talk about in various clients that you've had, watching women sort of say, well, we're old. You know, we're not supposed mm-hmm. to, you know, that doesn't, shouldn't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about that.
Well, first of all, I think that you should be doing this pitch to many more people, because there really is an anti-aging and sexuality message out there that as we get older, we should be less interested in, and I think often we're more interested in, as you say, can enjoy it more.
It helps your body more, yeah. Go ahead.
You know your body more, and you know that adage, use it or lose it. I mean, the more people enjoy themselves sexually, the more they enjoy sex. So,
and sometimes the less sex you have, the less sex you want. I think that's
right.
True as well, and you point that out in the book.
Yeah. You know, I think the hormone hypothesis, I wouldn't argue with the fact that for some women, particularly if they go through like a radical hysterectomy and sudden loss of the ovaries, so it's a sudden decrease in estrogen, testosterone, that there's some loss in sexual interest. Because I've heard too many people, you know, who I really believe went through that. And in that case, a medical solution can really help. But I just think that angle is so overrated. And there are many other women, as you say, who say they're enjoying sex more and even in feeling more physical pleasure.
You're listening to Out in the Bay. I'm Marilyn Pittman. My guest is Dr. Glenda Corwin, an Atlanta clinical psychologist and the author of Sexual Intimacy for Women, A Guide for Same-Sex Couples from Perseus Books. You can find her at drglendacorwin.com. You write a chapter, Doctor, entitled Sexual Abuse and Trauma. Do mm-hmm. lesbians experience a higher rate of this? I mean, that's been a common misperception or perception in our community for a really long time, is that women have trouble with sex because they were abused, or that's why they've shut down, or that's why they have lesbian. I mean, that's certainly, I'm mm-hmm. just reflecting back something in our culture that I've heard
yes.
over these years. What yeah. is your take on that?
Well, I'm glad you're bringing that up, because I think there's a lot of myths about that. First of all, there's a shamefully high incidence of sexual abuse of women and girls across all sexual orientations. And it's good that we're trying to address that and be honest about that. However, I don't know of any evidence that there's a greater incidence among lesbians. It's true that because there are two women in a lesbian relationship, there may be a higher likelihood that one has been a victim of some type of abuse.
So what does body image have to do with this, the problems that lesbians face in having the sexuality between them decrease or die?
Well, that's a huge factor. In fact, on one of the questionnaires that I give people when they come to a workshop, asking what are the most negative influences on your sex life, mm-hmm. Body image is absolutely number one. That's always given as the most negative influence. And it's interesting to me, often the woman who considers herself overweight is the one who says that she can't be sexual because of that. Often her partner, who is not overweight, is saying, but I want you anyway, you know, I desire you. I'm not hung up on your weight. She's the one who is. So that's just because I've sat in workshops and seen some women who looked absolutely, you know, by outside standards, you know, very buff, working out all the time, look great, etc., and say that their body image interferes with them feeling sexual, and then their partners are just looking at them like, you're crazy. But I don't mean to minimize, though. I mean, there's a weight issue in our community, and I think one of the epidemiological studies finds that twice as many lesbians are considered obese or morbidly obese. It's a concern from a health point of view.
What kinds of things do you do? Do you employ techniques that would help a couple dealing with something like this?
Specifically with body image?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the word is really shame. I mean, many women feel tremendous shame about their body. And anything that you feel ashamed about, this may sound too simple, but talking about it in a non-judgmental atmosphere helps.
And that you mean therapy?
Yes. Mm-hmm. For instance, I've had the experience several times of talking with women who are, you know, consider themselves very overweight, who just spend a lot of hours in therapy talking about the amount of shame that they feel, the ways that they feel it. It's terrible what our culture does to women around weight in particular. And just the act of talking about it seems to release some of the energy that's tied up in that. And then the other thing is to really encourage people to look around at other people, because what you'll see, and I think I mentioned this in the book, a woman who went to Provincetown and just had the experience of walking around there and seeing a lot of other people who were, you know, her size, out seeming to have a good time and showing off their bodies, you know, and dancing. And it was a big relief to her. Anything that you feel ashamed about, it helps to know you're not the only one, and that people who you can identify with seem to be able to enjoy themselves. And these are not rapid cures, I know that, but I think, again, for anything shame, the tendency is to hide, and so therefore the cure, so to speak, is not to hide. It's to go ahead and expose those feelings and to take chances exposing yourself.
But I'm just wondering what kinds of success you may have had in helping women this way. Can you give us any specific examples?
I've worked with a number of couples where the sexual piece really was the core problem, and who are pretty solid in a lot of other areas. And I've seen a lot of success with these women because they take it seriously enough to show up for therapy to talk about it, and they're kind of excited to learn a pretty concrete approach to this, that we don't have to rely on magic or wait for these spontaneous feelings to come back, that it's okay to be deliberate and it's okay to be a little bit awkward, but just do it anyway. And for women who've been able to take that approach, I think it's been very helpful. It's very gratifying to me to hear women come in and talk a little bit about making love again, not in great detail, but the part where it's sad is that sometimes, and I think we all know this, people will focus on sex and then there's just a tremendous gap between them around some other issues too.
Well, sex is sort of a metaphor then in some sense, or a way that people control or work up other kinds of power struggles perhaps, yes? And you start opening that can of worms, you start opening that up by attending therapy. Sometimes the therapy itself, maybe if you've waited too long, can lead to the dissolution of the relationship. I mean, do you think that's true, that when people enter couples counseling that it means it's over almost?
It certainly looks like that, doesn't it?
Well, I don't know. I'm curious.
Yeah. I don't have, you know, once I remember, a long time ago, I remember seeing a statistic that with heterosexual couples that 70% of couples who go for therapy wind up divorcing.
It's just a way to help end it without, you know, killing each other or whatever.
Well, yes, and I think those are pretty negative statistics. I hope that things have improved some, but with lesbian couples, I would have to say still, I think a majority of the time with couples therapy, things have gone on for so long that there's just too much water under the bridge.
Mm-hmm. Do you recommend that people, I mean, how do we prevent that? How do we know inside of our relationships when we might seek out a therapist before it gets to be too late?
In an ideal world, I wish that we could all take a more preventative approach and a little more what's called psychoeducational, rather than waiting till things are a problem till you need remediation. And by that, I mean, in the ideal world, I wish that all couples, women when they get together, would talk about what their goals are, or their, have a sexual mission statement, for instance. You know, how important is this in our relationship, and how important is it to you and to me, and are we on the same page about that? I wish also, in this magical prevention world, that we talked about some basic communication skills early on, or learned some of those early in a relationship, such as how to listen without judging or trying to fix. You know, that basic empathic listening that most of us know we're supposed to do that. It's very hard to do, but it's extremely helpful.
Doctor, why did you write this book? I'm talking to Dr. Glenda mm-hmm. Corwin. She wrote this fantastic book, Sexual Intimacy for Women. Why write this book? What motivated you to share all of this incredible years of work you've done with individual clients and the research you've done with mm-hmm. the community at large?
Well, I'll tell you, I had professional motives and I had personal motives. Professionally, simply because this issue comes up so often, and so many women I've talked to are very unhappy about that and have approached it with an almost helpless, is there anything we can do about this, or should I just give up on sex? And so I wanted to say, no, don't give up. There are ways to, there are some myths you need to break through and ways to sustain a sexual life. But I'll tell you, honestly, personally, I came out when I was 29. I was married to a man before that. And, you know, coming out can be a pretty scary process. It's for a lot of people. And it was a big ordeal. But the thing that makes it worth it was this discovering sexual passion and realizing, oh, this is the part that hasn't quite been fitting for me before. And now I've found it. And, you know, because I've figured out my own sexual orientation. And so having discovered that for myself, when I started hearing about lesbian bed death, I thought, this isn't right. This is too good a thing to just set aside and not try to nurture, not protect this kind of energy, because it's pretty precious. And a lot of us went through a lot and still go through a lot to be able to express that part of ourselves. So that was a big motivation for writing.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on the program. It's fascinating to listen to you and have you share with us your wisdom and your years of experience and your intellect about this absolutely difficult thing to talk about. So hopefully we've uncovered some of the myths and some of the facts and some of the fictions. And I really want to thank you again, Doctor.
Well, I appreciate so much the chance to talk with you and to get this word out. You know, sexual intimacy is a good thing for all of us. So thanks for letting me talk about that.
You bet. Dr. Okay. Glenda Corwin, Atlanta psychotherapist and the author of Sexual Intimacy for Women. You can find her at drglendacorwin.com. You've been listening to Out in the Bay, a weekly show about gay life from San Francisco. I'm Marilyn Pittman, and we've been producing Out in the Bay for 5 years now, and we need your support. We do. It's easy. It's tax deductible. Just go to outinthebay.com and hit the donate now button. Keep us on the air. Our show airs and streams Thursdays at 7 p.m. Pacific, and then it's archived at outinthebay.com for podcasts and on-demand listening. And it's on your phone now, too. Just go to outinthebay.com and download the Stitcher app. Thanks to WY Enterprises for our website. They help you manage your life and your office, wyenterprises.com. Write us with your comments or questions. My email is marilyn@outinthebay.com. Eric Jansen's is eric@outinthebay.com. Thanks to the staff and management of KALW, our engineer is Alan Farley. Out in the Bay is produced by Eric Jansen and me. I'm Marilyn Pittman. Thanks for joining me.